most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics will participate in our meetings. Good evening. My name is Duffy, and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of the meeting has been temporarily amended. We will read a portion of chapter 5, have a 15-minute speaker, read 12 traditions, followed by our main speaker for 30 minutes. Tonight, Joey has been asked to read the portion of chapter 5.
Turn your volume down.
Sorry.
Good evening. My name is Joey, and I'm an alcoholic. This is chapter 5, How It Works. Rarely have we seen a person who fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us, but there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives under the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order, I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we are alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power can relieve our alcoholism. And C, that God couldn't, what if you were sought?
Thank you, Joey. I'd like to introduce our first speaker for this evening, and that is our very own Morgan D. Thank you, Morgan. There he is. You're muted, Morgan. There you go.
All right. Hey, everybody. Alcoholic.
And let me spot my me there. Oh, woof, too much. Step back. Hey, I want to thank Duffy for doing this, and everybody's been great. So please don't text for the next 15 minutes. Let me hit my little timer here. I'm going to start my 15-minute timer on my computer. Perfect. So welcome. Yeah, it's an honor to be asked to participate in my home group. I want to thank Duffy again for doing that and for asking me to help put this together. I'm glad to be of service. I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself, what it was like, what happened, and what my life is like today. I grew up in, I was born on the West Side. I'm a local Angeleno. My father was actually born in Los Angeles. My drunken relatives come from Oklahoma, go Jim Shaw, and Irish as well, Irish background. And, you know, in my family, you know, my dad used to be a heavy drinker. On his side of the family, we, you know, maybe had some alcoholics. I heard stories about my grandfather who died when I was 1 year old, you know, taking the special canteen on camping trips. That was the snake bite medicine that the kids weren't allowed to drink, you know, stuff like that. And on my mother's side, they all came from New Jersey, and they were all a bunch of alcoholics. They were known as the Drunken Mallorics around Newark, New Jersey. And I think a few of them actually died in their 50s of alcoholism. And for me, growing up, I always felt different, always felt afraid. I really relate with the people that say, I wish, you know, I was waiting for the spaceship to take me back home. And, you know, I just never really fit in. I was good at sports, though, and I always seemed to get approval playing sports. I was good at football, baseball, all those things. And, you know, so... yeah, I was real small growing up, and I would get picked on a lot and beat up, but, you know, I could hold my own in sports and get some kind of respect. My first dabs with alcohol, my father always had, there was always alcohol in our house growing up, and my dad was a heavy drinker, and I would always take sips of the booze and stuff like that. Then he would ask me to get a beer out of the fridge, and I get a beer, and I drink like half the beer before I gave it to him. And, you know, I like the taste of beer and the booze. And I was a latchkey kid. You know, I grew up in the 70s and watched a lot of TV. One of my favorite shows was MASH. And for those of you that are familiar with MASH, a couple of the main characters, they were basically alcoholics. They were just getting drunk all the time and doing surgery. You know, there you go. And they had a still in their tent. And one episode, they played checkers with their martini glasses. And we decided, a couple of my buddies, like, hey, that's how we'll get drunk. Let's get drunk. We made a plan. Let's get drunk. And we decided we were going to play MASH checkers. We got a hold of some shot glasses. And, you know, we every time you jumped, you'd take a shot. And if you got kinged, it was a double shot. And my first night, my first drunk, I had 13 shots of whiskey. And I love the effect that alcohol gave me. And I always, you know, was like, I want to do this a lot. You know, I love this feeling. I want to do this a lot. Now, I'm 13 years old. It's not readily available. We would hang out at the local liquor store and try to get people to buy us some beer. And, you know, we'd get by where we could. You know, I started at this point, you know, started ditching a lot of school. I was actually, this was like the summer, going into the summer of eighth grade. I was trying out for the freshman football team in high school. I went through Hell Week and all that stuff. And then we put on the pads. And again, I was a smaller kid. I had skipped second grade, so I was younger and smaller. And once those pads got put on, I just started flying around the football field. I'm like, this is no fun. And it was about that time, too, that Fast Times at Ridgemont High came out. And I was like, you know, Jeff Spicoli, he's my man. That's what I want to be like. And, you know, again, alcohol wasn't super readily available, and we were drinking more on the weekends. And about that time, we discovered teen nightclubs. And, you know, this is the early 1980s, and we used to go to a place called Osco's. It was like my first teen dance club. It's where I got my first cigarettes, you know, because girls like cigarettes. So I had to get some cigarettes to give to girls and meet girls. And, you know, that kind of started, basically a habit, you know, a ritual where on the weekends, you know, it was about getting drunk, and the weekends turned into weekdays. I ditched a lot of school. I don't think my school today knows what my parents' real signature looks like because I forged it so many times. But I always got away with stuff. You know, I never got caught, never got in trouble. There was one time I was a hoodlum too, a little bit. When we were about that age, we used to drive around Culver City, probably around John Lichty's neighborhood as well. We'd have hammers and we just go on our bikes and we would just smash side view mirrors of cars with our hammers for fun. We'd throw eggs at houses. And one time, you know, my buddy got caught and, you know, he ratted us all out, but for some reason I got very light punishment is what I remember. I kept drinking more and more through high school. Started going to 3-2-1 Club in Santa Monica. My alcoholism really progressed going there. Wanted to get drunk. And, you know, it was just to fit in. You know, I drank because I was so afraid. You know, drinking just, you know, took away the fear and just made me feel a part of and took away all my inhibitions. But my school suffered as a result. It's funny, I got my transcripts. I was like a 2.0 in high school. I took PE 3 times my senior year because I had so many fails, I had to make it up. And, you know, school just became, unimportant. And it's not like today, for those of you who have kids, you know that, you know, you'll get a friggin' text message if your kid gets a C on their report card or even a grade. Back then, you know, we didn't have that. I used to forge my report cards when they came in the mail because I used to get money for A's. So I would turn F's into A's. D's and the B's, because it was all about the money for me. And big turning point in my alcoholism where it really started going downhill. I got the best job for a pubescent 16-year-old alcoholic. I got a job working at Chippendales. And Chippendales, it was great. I was getting money from women every night. Now, as you know, I had to give them change because I was only a parking attendant. So it's not like I was a dancer or anything like that. But thank you, Debbie, for that one.
You're welcome.
The guys there, these guys, you know, they had the strippers were like, you know, these butch macho guys, super muscular. And I think Clancy said before, it's like I drank to feel like they looked, you know, I wanted to be part of that. And those guys kind of accepted me there. And I quickly got into a little side business in the parking lot, selling some white powdery substance. And, soon I became my best customer. And, you know, I tried anything. I was a garbage pail. I tried anything. And, eventually that business got real bad. And I got found out. My mom found out. I'm 18 years old and, you know, my mom finds out about my side business. And, I had been doing this now for like a couple years and I knew I was getting bad. I was getting worse. It's like, well, maybe if I just like went away to like, I think Lake Arrowhead had a treatment program at that time. I'm like, if I just get out of here, do a geographic, I think I'd be okay. And, instead I got sent to Carson 4 nights a week for outpatient. And, that wasn't really helping. I was still going back to the club, still drinking, still drugging, doing all that stuff. And, sometimes I wouldn't even show up to the outpatient. I'd start driving there and I'd just turn my car around. And the counselor said, you know, you should go to these meeting things. You know, it's like, you know, you should do that. And there's these step things you should do, but you're not quite ready for them yet. And so I wasn't really working any steps or anything like that. And eventually what happened was, one more time, I went on a bender. And I was driving my car and I did want to go, but somehow my car just kept getting there. And it got to the parking lot of the outpatient place. And I said, well, I'll just sit in the parking lot. And I sat there for a while and I said, well, I'll go into the stairwell. And I went into the stairwell and, I just sat there and I said that, prayer that we all say. I didn't really pray. I just like, please help me. I just sat in the stairs and I said, please help me. And right about that time, the counselor came down. He said, I think it's time you go to a 30-day detox. And I said, yeah, I think you're right. So I quickly got shipped off to detox a few days later. And I walked into Long Beach, actually. I had a treatment facility called Pacific Health Systems. It was connected with the Pacific Hospital down there. And, I didn't know what to expect. I came in smiling. I was like, I had a stupid grin on my face and people say, hey, Morgan, people don't come in here smiling. And I said, I can't help it. I just felt like, this was going to, I was going to find some help or find another way. And I still didn't know anything about AA yet until, you know, I think once I got out of detox, after a couple of days, they put me in this group and everybody sat around. They had the big book and they started reading from the big book and they read like a couple paragraphs and then people went around and shared. And this guy, you know, to my left, this Marine corporal, I have nothing in common with, you know, he starts talking about how he relates to something in the book and sharing his experience. And for the first time I identified with somebody that felt the same way I did. You know, I didn't think anybody felt like I did. I thought my case was different. And, you know, here around the room, you know, all these people started sharing and I totally identified. And from that, you know, that was May 10th, 1988 is when I got checked in and I haven't had to drink or anything from the neck up since then. And, you know, I didn't do it perfect at the beginning in the treatment center. They wrap, you know, they get you through the steps. And I did my three steps in 30 days. And then they said, okay, go out and get a sponsor, go to meetings. And I decided to stay down there. They had a recovery house associated with the treatment program. So I stayed down there. That corporal, Marine corporal, became my roommate. And he didn't have a car. I had a car. So I was driving into meetings every day. And he had a sponsor. I didn't have a sponsor. You know, you know, I've been drinking for so long and I wanted to, you know, sow my oats. I had been locked up for 30 days. So I wanted to have fun, hang out with the girls. And I was doing that and not working any steps. And, you know, but I would hang out with that guy after meetings because I had to drive him home. And his sponsor would tell him, you know, I want you to write tonight. I want you to do this. I want you to do that. And I said, you know, I'll do that too. Even though I don't have a sponsor, that sounds like a good idea. So maybe I should do it too. So I was doing those things without really having a sponsor in name. And then finally the pain got great enough where, you know, I finally surrendered and asked his sponsor to be my sponsor. And it was a big surrender for me because this sponsor was known as the celibate sponsor in our group. And, you know, no relationships in your first year, not even with yourself. And I was like, "Ooh, that's hardcore." But, you know, I was willing to do what, you know, ever this guy told me to do. And did an inventory with that guy. And I started, you know, I went back to school. I had dropped out of Santa Monica College, took all incompletes, and went back in the fall of 88 and started shuffling around some different meetings. They had meetings at the college campus, and that's where I met some people from specific group. And you can kind of tell, like, there were some crazy people at those Santa Monica meetings, and then there was people that seemed to, like, get their life together. And that was the attraction for me with these guys getting their lives together. A guy like John Broderick or John B. was in that meeting. And Leslie was there and Nate and, you know, and John said, "Hey, why don't you come play softball?" So I started playing softball at the yard and, you know, got involved with sober softball and started going to more Pacific group meetings. And eventually after about 10 months of sobriety of kind of loafing around a little bit, you know, I got myself a Pacific group sponsor, Steve Z, and started doing this thing 100%. And, you know, in the past, you know, 32 years, you know, life has had its ups and downs. You know, I was fortunate enough, you know, if you're new out there dialing in or on the meeting, you know, I was fortunate enough to connect, you know, early in Pacific Group with this skinny, pimply faced puke named Sean C. And he, you know, he liked golf. I liked golf. So we started doing this golf thing. We found other people that liked golf and, we started this golf tournament and, you know, that's been going on for, you know, 32 years now. And, you know, he didn't have a car either. So I was driving him to meetings. We had people driving him to meetings, you know, but we had that core group of guys that, you know, we talked with each other on a daily basis. We kept each other on track and wouldn't let each other slide. A couple years into sobriety also, I met her on AA campus, saw this, you know, I had again been, you know, I had gotten freedom from the abstinence when I came to Pacific Group and got a year and, you know, started, you know, dated around and stuff for about a year. Then, you know, met my wife, Andrea, on AA campus. And, you know, we've been, this July, we'll have been married 27 years. And it's funny, my kids were last night, were like, "Hey, we want to see your wedding video." So we threw up our wedding video and like everybody was like, when it was coming time for like, you know, the best man and our sponsors to talk, everybody was saying like, "Well, we had concerns at the beginning. We didn't know about these two." And I was like, "Why?" You know? And I mean, we only got engaged like 4 months after we met, but you know, we waited until I finished college, and I did that. I finished college, got a job, started doing grown-up stuff, you know, life stuff. And, you know, again, you know, we have some great kids today. We adopted two kids in sobriety because we couldn't have them on our own. And, you know, they're off in college now. Actually, they're all at my house right now because we're all locked up. They both got kicked out. And, you know, with what's going on, it's a scary thing. But, you know, I'm glad that I'm up. And that is the buzzer. Oops. And so I'll just wrap up with this. You know, I'm glad I'm sober and to be able to be here for them and be a good example, you know, and not be drunk and, you know, drinking my misery away. So again, I'm grateful to this group, grateful to my friends, my family, all of you. And thank you, Duffy, again, for letting me share.
Thank you so much, Morgan. That was wonderful. AA also has a set of traditions which apply to the group conscience in much the same manner that the 12 steps apply to the individual. Tonight, Patty has been asked to read the 12 traditions.
Hi, I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, these are the 12 traditions. Hi, Duffy. Hi. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself. In our group conscience, our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Thank you.
Thank you, Patty. Love you. Love you too. I'd like to introduce our main speaker for this evening. It is Gemma. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Gemma and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Gemma.
Hi. Thank you, Duffy, for asking me to speak. It is an honor to be here. Thank you to Duffy and Morgan for setting up this Zoom call and everyone who was involved. Right now, my husband is upstairs in our office. He's hosting a Men's Stag Zoom Al-Anon meeting, and I'm in our bedroom talking to at least 649 alcoholics, and oh, it just went down to 648. Okay. Oh, and we're back. And I am so moved by the way Alcoholics Anonymous has mobilized in this past week, how meetings have come together to make sure that the hand of AA is there. And in this time when everything is changing, or lots of things are changing, I am clinging to the things that I know will never change. And for me, that is knowing that I am an alcoholic. I cannot drink safely, and I never will be able to. And my primary purpose is to stay sober and help another alcoholic achieve sobriety. I know that those things are not going to change. And, you know, I'm so honored to be here. And I'm wearing a dress. I'm wearing heels. My husband sweetly said, honey, I don't know if you need to wear heels. Your ankle is sprained in three places and no one's going to see your feet. And I was like, I am not speaking at the Pacific Group barefoot. It's not happening. He, of course, didn't even suggest that. I just went, I'm an alcoholic, so I went from heels to barefoot. But maybe he meant a sensible shoe. But I'm here, and I'm happy to be here. So my sobriety date is July 5th, 1996. I adjusted the date a couple years ago because when I was a newcomer, I lied. And it became clear to me that if I didn't change the date, I might have to change the year. And so that is my date. And, you know, my whole life, I have been plagued by two things. And I just realized I didn't set a timer, so I'm doing that right now. I've been plagued by two things, scary stories and big feelings. And they're like a pair of mischievous twins, you know, one makes the other one bigger. And so for me, at a very young age, I found my body and my mind uninhabitable. And it wasn't because of my family. I come from a loving home. I have a mom who was a priest and a dad who is a therapist. My dad got sober when I was 5. And when he passed away a few years ago, he had 35 years of continuous sobriety. If they could have loved or educated this disease out of me, I know that they would have. But that's not how it works. And you know, so I started reaching outside of myself from an early age, you know, with things to change how I felt, be it sugar or TV or fantasy or lots of different things. And then one day I discovered alcohol at communion, and it immediately was this thing that just quieted the scary stories and softened my feelings. And I knew at 5 that it was going to be my answer. And so I, alcohol was hard to find in a sober home. And I got really young that, like, if I had a hard day, you know, that vanilla extract or NyQuil could just take the edge off of 5th grade. And I started drinking all the time around, I guess I was 12 or 13. You know, alcohol was hard to come by. I had to do a lot of things for it. And I'm a squeamish person, but when it came to alcohol, it never mattered. You know, I would fish a cigarette butt out of something. Or I remember one time, you know, finding, I lived in New York City, and I found a tiny baby roach in the cap of the bottle that I was able to access. And like, I just cleaned it out and went for it anyway, you know, which is not something I would normally do. I loved alcohol so much. I loved the effect. I loved the warmth, and I loved how it made me feel safe. And what I didn't love were the consequences. And I am someone who has consequences when I drink. I black out, I pass out, I throw up, I get alcohol poisoning, I do embarrassing things, I degrade myself, it's never good. You know, when I drank, it didn't matter how long I was at a party, like something that I did would make it to the next day. And a lot of nights where I drank, like, had names, you know, like Gemma and the red dress, or, you know, Gemma and the lost glasses, you know, like, and they sounds like bad mystery novels, but just something I did, you know, would make it to the next night. And I took sort of some pride in that, you know. I remember being 16 years old, and I went to a party, and I got really drunk, and I got really sick. And one of the things that I would do at parties was hop in your bathtub or your shower. I was under the impression that that would help me feel better. And so then I eventually passed out at this party, and my sober dad found the address. This was before cell phones. He found the address to the party, and he drove out. And he found me passed out, soaking wet, and a mess. And my friends were there, and they said they would take care of me. So he just left me there. And I remember my takeaway the next day was that I was glad that the person I had hooked up with had been married, because then that would have been embarrassing. And, you know, I didn't know that my dad had been there. And so I woke up in the morning and I drove home with, I couldn't find my glasses and I was still drunk and I can barely see. So it was not a good situation. I drove home and I snuck into the house and I pretended that I was there all night. And that was the day that my parents started going to Al-Anon. And with me as their qualifier, but they never nagged me and they never talked to me about my drinking, really. We kept an open dialogue and I talked to them about, you know, what was going on, and they didn't say anything. And I know that that was hard for them. And I know that every time the phone rang at night, they were terrified. And when I was in college, something happened. I don't even really remember what, but it caused me to worry about my drinking. And so I decided that I would stop drinking to prove to myself that I wasn't an alcoholic. And so for 3 weeks, I didn't drink and I didn't have a program and I just white knuckled it. And I was so proud of myself. You know, I was so miserable, but I was so relieved because I had gone 3 weeks without drinking. And I thought that meant I didn't have this thing, that I had proved to everyone that I didn't have a problem. And to celebrate and to reward myself, I got really drunk. And, you know, I have a allergy to alcohol. And once I have alcohol in me, there is a phenomenon of craving and I cannot stop. And I think it was a few years after that, that I got, I moved to New York. I thought maybe my school was the problem. So I went to New York, back where I was from. And one night I went out drinking. I was going to go out for one drink, but one drink turned into one drink in every bar on St. Mark's Place. And I had alcohol poisoning that night. I had been up for 14 hours throwing up. And my father showed up. At this point, I think he had 15 years sober. And, you know, I have to remember like my last drink, which is that I had just toilet seat marks on my forehead and my chin from going back and forth in the toilet for all night long. And I had linoleum marks on my face and from sleeping on the bathroom floor, and I had vomit on my clothes. And, you know, and I said, "Hi, Daddy, you know, come on in." And he came in and we talked about what was going on for me. And I was really honest with him because I had that kind of willingness that you get from alcohol poisoning. And I told him my truth. And I told him the things that I was doing for alcohol and all the lines that I had been crossing, and that I was maybe going to marry a guy from Morocco for $3,000. And did he have any suggestions on what to do with the money? Because I wanted to be smart with it. And, you know, he didn't say anything. But a couple days later, my mother said, "Here's the deal. We love you and we are sending you to college and it's really expensive. We're making a lot of sacrifices and we think you're going to die and it's not a good investment. So if you want to go to school, you have to get sober." And so I didn't come to AA willing, and I didn't come, on my own idea. It was just a sort of a bizarre tuition program. And I, when I got here, you know, there was a meeting that had just started. It was called Never Had a Legal Drink. And that meeting saved my life because there were other people who were young and they had the same loophole that I had, that it wasn't even, you know, I was 19 years old. It wasn't even legal for me to be drinking in the first place. And I hung out with a group of people and, you know, we did this thing together and there was incredible fellowship in that group, and it kept me sober. And, you know, my experience is that willingness doesn't always feel like wanting to, and acceptance doesn't always feel like liking it. And I just kept showing up, and I still had this deep feeling like maybe I didn't have this thing, you know? When I had about 4 years of sobriety, I went to, I called my sponsor and I said, you know, I want a drink. And she said, where are you? And I said, I'm at the International AA Convention. And she said, oh, okay. What are you going to have? And I said, I don't know. And she said, where are you going to get it? And I said, I don't know. And she said, I don't think you want to drink. I think you want to feel better. And for me, I am keeping that really close to me always, but especially now. Because I have a mind that will associate, you know, drinking with feeling better, even though that is never what alcohol did for me. Maybe temporarily, but not permanently. And so ever since then, that sponsor was really careful about language. She had me be really careful about language. Like, I didn't say things like everybody hates me, or, you know, even if it felt that way, or I want a drink, I would replace it with precision of language, exactly what I was trying to say, you know? And that's something that when I feel that feeling of I want a drink, I just replace it with I want relief, or I want to feel safe. And then I go about getting into the solution of finding a way to do that, you know, that precision of language. Like, I don't ever talk about casually about divorce with my husband. I don't joke about that. And in these times, I don't casually talk about, like, you know, end of the world or the apocalypse for me, because I get so scared, and and it just leads to scary stories and big feelings. And so I just am, you know, just staying in the moment and being careful about that. And so, you know, I got sober, and I was, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. You know, last year, something happened around this time of the year, and it cracked me open. You know, I had over 20 years of sobriety, and I just had an experience that just opened me up. And I, as I say, like, the wheels fell off the bus. It caused me to question a lot of things, and I cried a lot, and I didn't know like, up or down. I was so overwhelmed and so filled with grief. And, you know, this past week has given me the perspective that actually everything was totally fine, but I didn't know that. And what I did was, besides a lot of crying, I went to my sponsor and I asked to go back through the steps. And you know, I began at the beginning, you know, and so I'm just gonna quickly go through what the steps have meant to me, especially in this past year, which, you know, was difficult and painful, but absolutely worth it, because this thing works, and I really got into the solution, right? So step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. You know, that is absolutely the case for me. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. You know, I realized in this last year that I had a higher power, but I didn't believe in it restoring me to sanity. You know, or that it was the only way. I thought there were other ways I could be restored to sanity. You know, if only, like, I could get this job or that person or the correct kitchen tile or the right pants, you know, something on the outside that could make me feel better. I was always looking for that. And even in my sobriety, like, I didn't rely on a spiritual solution. You know, I had a higher power, but I didn't forge a relationship, you know, and so I think that I just didn't have a spiritual solution, you know. And then in the third step, like we talk about, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. I did the third step with my sponsor. We were on our knees, we held hands. And then I got in the car and I was driving home. And as I was driving home, I was on Coldwater and there was a FedEx truck in front of me and it turned around, it did a U-turn and it was coming at me. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, I knew it. I just turned my will and my life over to God and now I'm going to get hit by a truck, you know? And I said it out loud. I said, I knew it. And it's that thing, you know, like if you have a thing with a friend where they say like, oh, you know, my boyfriend left and you're like, oh, good. I never liked that person anyway. Or they're like, no, I meant like just to the store. I had that with God, like where I had said out loud, I knew it, you know? And I realized in that moment that despite all the evidence, I had this feeling that if I turned my will and my life over to God, that meant that I wasn't going to be taken care of. And so I had a second surrender right there in my car. And, you know, there's a story that I used to tell all the time when I share, and I haven't been telling it as much, but I am going to tell it now, which is that, you know, when my husband and I first moved into our house, when we first got married, in the backyard, there was a lime tree, and I am from New York, and so I felt like a farmer. I was so excited, and people would say to us, like, we're coming over, what can we bring? And I was like, don't bring limes, we have a tree. And the first party, people came over, and I went to get a lime, and they were hard as a rock. And I was like, it's okay. My crop is not ready for harvest. But then the next week, same thing, hard as a rock, hard as a rock, hard as a rock. And I started to, cause I'm an alcoholic, I started to just sort of resent the tree. And, it became a symbol of how things just don't really work out for me. And, you know, summer ended and good riddance. And, one day in November, I came home. My husband was living, it was in the living room and he was eating an orange and I knew I hadn't bought it because I resented all citrus at this point. And I said, where did you get that? And he said, from the lime tree. And we went outside and we looked at this tree that was covered in oranges. And he said to me, who told you this was a lime tree? And I said, no one. It just really looked like one. And that's my experience of alcoholism, you know, that I decide what something is supposed to look like. And then when it doesn't behave the way I want it to behave, I get really resentful. And so I'm so grateful for inventory because I get to, you know, deal with my resentments, you know, make it a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And I'd done that in the past, but I really did it again this year. And I did a whole inventory. It was 200 pages. I didn't know I was that angry, but I was that angry. And there's this thing that's great that if there's something that keeps happening to me, you know, as an adult, that there's probably something that I keep doing. And I get to examine that. And then with my sponsor and with a higher power, I get the chance to do something different and get a different result. And, you know, I've had, entire relationships change because of inventory, you know, I've had, been able to get to from resenting someone to being able to get to compassion, you know, and I'm so grateful for that tool. My sponsor, I did my fifth step with my sponsor, you know, admitted to God, to ourselves and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. And my sponsor took a day off work and she listened for 6 hours as I read this massive inventory. And she identified with the things that I was saying and she didn't judge me. And she said, me too. I have felt like that. I have done that. Me too. And she was able to hear all of the ugliest things that I had to say. And at the end of it, she loved me anyway. And I think that's the beauty of the fifth step, you know, that we get to share that with someone else and we get compassion from someone else. And then maybe we can have a little bit of compassion for ourselves. I did the inventory differently than I've done in the past. I was very thorough and I was very clear, but I did it with some compassion for myself, just as I would have compassion for my son. You know, when he makes a mistake, I'm not like, "Oh, you're awful. Oh," you know, I say, "Okay, I see what you did, see what you did here. And here's what we could do differently," you know? And so that's how I approached the inventory this time. I looked at my defects of character, you know, and I used to think I was really broken and I had 1,000 defects of character, but I now know I have like 10 defects of character that show up in 1,000 places. And I get to work on those. And I know that fear makes my defects grow. And so I try really hard to keep myself out of fear as much as I possibly can. You know, the seventh step humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. For me, the seventh step is all about contrary action, you know, doing the opposite thing of what I want to do or say. And, you know, I've learned this week, especially, you know, to say things like, "You might be right. That's a great idea. I hadn't thought of it that way," you know, and those phrases have been helping me. I'm always afraid I'm not going to get what I want or I'm going to lose what I have. That's just how I roll, you know? And so, you know, in spite of that, just showing up in spite of that, you know, I'm just doing the best I can, in the face of fear, you know. And there was a sober man by the name of Al Sines. He had 55 years, I believe, when he passed away this past year. And he used to I didn't know him personally, but I know people who did, and they've told me about him, and I've met him a few times. But he used to wear a rubber band around his wrist, and when he felt hypnotized by fear or scary stories, whatever that is, he would just sort of snap it and say, "Right here, right now, right here, right now," just bringing it back that I'm right here with God and I'm right here in the moment. And so I've been, I think this came from broccoli, this rubber band, and I've been wearing it this week. So anyway, then the eighth step, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. I did that this year. I made amends to people. I made the list, and then I did the ninth step. I made amends to all the people that I had harmed in my drinking. And a lot of those amends were, you know, 23 years old. And I went back and I was able to make amends to people. And, you know, I realized that the one person I didn't make direct amends to was my father. And I had a lot of guilt about that. And then it was pointed out to me that for the last 20 years of his life, when the phone rang late at night, he didn't have to worry. And when he had Parkinson's and dementia and was, you know, in a home, like, I would visit him. And not because I'm some great person, but because Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to do that. And so I had made a living amends to him, and I also wrote him a letter. And, you know, the 10th step is so important, right now, especially continue to take personal inventory. And when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I just want to read, real quick, from the 10th step in the 12 and 12. Our first objective will be the development of self-restraint. This carries a top priority rating. When we speak or act hastily or rashly, the ability to be fair-minded and tolerant evaporates on the spot. One unkind tirade or willful snap judgment can ruin our relation with another person for a whole day or maybe a whole year. Nothing pays off like restraint of pen and tongue. We must avoid quick-tempered criticism and furious, power-driven arguments. The same goes for sulking or silent scorn. These are emotional booby traps baited with pride and vengefulness. Our first job is to sidestep these traps. When we are tempted by the bait, we should train ourselves to step back and think, for we can neither think nor act to good purpose until the habit of self-restraint has become automatic. You know, for me, every time I get a resentment during the day, it's like putting a dirty dish in the sink, you know, and or if I do or say something, it's just, and those dishes add up. And so at the end of the day, especially now, I'm going to take a look at the sink and I'm seeing what's there. And some of the things are also the things that I've done right, but I'm trying not to let that sink get full and trying not to let it add up. You know, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Nope. Sorry, I already did that. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, only praying for his knowledge, for his will for us and the power to carry that out. You know, in this year, I have developed a meditation practice that is really strong and, you know, not perfect, but I do 20 minutes a day and it's really been helping me. And, you know, I'm just going to say one of the things in the 12th step when we talk about carrying the message, you know, I have a friend, Max, who in this year when I was having a hard time said to me, you know how when you're having a hard time, when you get in the middle, everything gets better. When you take a commitment and you raise your hand and you get in the middle, everything gets better. And I said, yeah, I'm doing all that. And he said, I need you to do that in your home, like get in the middle of your marriage. And so I started to be in the middle of my marriage and I started to take commitments in my home. And, you know, I took the coffee commitment where I made my husband coffee, and I took the creator commitment where I said good morning to him and said hello to him, first thing in the morning, you know, before I got into the tirade of what we needed to do for the day. And as a result of doing all of these things, you know, I had a spiritual awakening this year because this thing works. And I just want to close with saying that, you know, what I'm doing now is I'm working my program harder than ever. I am waking up in the morning and I am praying and meditating. I am going to at least 2 Zoom meetings a day. I try to do that first thing in the morning. I have a network of friends that I'm in constant contact with, that I am reaching out to all the time, who I can talk to and who know what's going on with me. I talk to my sponsor. I talk to my sponsees. I'm going to work do step work with them. And I've been meaning to read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers for 23 years, and I'm going to do that. You know, I'm so grateful to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful that I'm an alcoholic so that I get to be in AA. And we have this spiritual set of tools to live by. And I'm grateful that I have that. And I'm just going to close now by reading just the last paragraph of A Vision for You. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Gemma. We are going to unmute all 650 people. We're going to give her a big round of applause.
Hey. Unbelievable. Hey. Thank you, Gemma.
Thank you, Gemma.
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 She's getting
I think there's still that we need to mute Morgan. Thank you again, Gemma. That was wonderful.
Hold on, Duffy. Sorry, I muted you by mistake too. I muted everybody again. Hold on, let me unmute you. There we go.
Okay. Hello, everybody. This is the conclusion of the Pacific Group meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You are cordially invited to meet with us again next Wednesday night online. Same site, same number, same ID number that you have access to right now, and to become a regular member of our group. All the participants will again be sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Special announcements. We have one. Please visit pgaa.org. How do you like that? I'll hold it still. Write it down. Please visit pgaa-aa.org. Once again, it is pg-aa.org. There we go. For all updates and a list of the Pacific Group meetings online. It will have the links for each night of the week. We'll have Ohio Street Way of Life. So just go to that website and you can check in with the other Pacific Group meetings that we have throughout the week. I want to thank all of our participants. You've done a great job for our first Pacific Group online meeting. And once again, thank you again very much, Gemma. Wonderful, wonderful talk tonight. I also want to give a shout out to Clancy. He is online listening to all of us. So maybe you can all wave to Clancy. There we go. And we're going to unmute to everybody again, and we're going to close with the Lord's Prayer. If you could just kind of, whisper as we say it, but we'll all be unmuted and we'll pray ourselves out. And I wish you all blessings as, we encounter what's ahead of us and with us right now, and that we're all safe and sound and sober. Let's stay sober. Let's reach out and be of service to God and those about us as we encounter the days ahead. So as soon as we end with the Lord's Prayer, then that will be the end of our meeting. So thank you very much. And I'm just going to start it as everybody's unmuted now.
Do you see me?